listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
We're so lucky. You can text us at 2057, but right now we've got Brad Flutie. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Rodney. Great to be here.
Oh, you've got no idea what it is to see you. We were very, very worried for you.
Yeah, thank you. But I've been through some pretty difficult things in my life and still here.
Yes, and you have got so much love and support from us and all the listeners, 100%, mate.
Yeah, it was great to finally go through all the messages when I got out. There was so much. I just spent an entire day replying to all of them.
Oh, how lovely. Thank you.
It was actually unreal. I've never seen anything like it before. I went to a meeting in Greton, and they twisted my arm into speaking at this meeting. I wasn't supposed to speak, and everyone gave me a standing ovation. I've never experienced that before. It was difficult to take in.
Your mum is the best mum.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's in many difficult situations. In there, she was actually the hero because the ambulance wasn't coming unless she was calling it.
Wow. Mm. That is, and gosh, I love her. And she was so strong for you, Brad.
Yep. She had her moments, but she pushed through, as we all do.
There's nothing like a mum's love. Yep. And you don't want to get between a mum and her cub.
Yeah, not that one anyway.
No. Now, I want to learn all about what it's like to be locked up because I can't imagine it. I can't imagine what you've been through. We've got time. A lot's happened. I just want to take it. We're not going to talk about the charges and all that rubbish. That's for another day. I just want to talk about you getting picked up and how it all unfolded that you ended up on this hunger strike and how it seemed to us that they were quite willing to let you die.
Yeah, so I guess we'll start from day one. I actually remember the last thing that I ate before embarking on what would be a 73-day hunger strike. I never intended for an amount of time that I could define. I just decided that what was happening was unlawful, that these entities were responsible for what I interpreted as an unlawful detainment. And so I didn't think it was reasonable to take sustenance from them. So I created a framework from the immediate moment I was detained that this is my requirements. I require sustenance from trusted sources. I don't believe you to be a trusted source for good reason, and I laid out the very precise reasons, and that I require water and electrolytes that are in line with your policies and procedures to be brought in by family in sealed bottles. I'm not looking to compromise the security of your organization, security in quotations, of course. And that was laid out to them right from the start. And if they couldn't fulfill those obligations, then a hunger strike would be the result. They interpreted that as me refusing food and water and embarked on a campaign of trying all sorts of strategies to coerce me into taking what they had to offer. And that carried on intermittently for 73 days. What started was the depriving of contact. So when I was detained by the police on the Tuesday of the 16th of July, I was taken to a cell in the Tauranga police station. I didn't get any contact with my family. I also didn't get any contact with any potential legal support that I might want to engage in or any support from lawful counsel or something like that. I went to the court the next day. A bunch of events unfolded. I was taken back to the police station. I went close to 72 hours without water during this period. The police tried to drag me out of the cell. I found out later I was having salt cramps at the time. That's why I couldn't really move. In fact, they told me that. But they dragged me out of the cell. Some of the officers were all good. They were trying to do it gently. But there was a sergeant there who basically thought I was faking the whole thing. So he grabbed my hands and my fingers and tried to bend them back so I would be in pain and would comply with them trying to move me into a bus to the hub in Rotorua. It failed because I would have been around 125, 126 kgs at this stage. So they dragged me back to a cell in front of their base of operations and left me there on the ground. And then about at 11 p.m. at night, they called my partner and asked her to bring some water and some stuff in for me. So I got some water then. So it was about 72 hours before they actually allowed that stuff to come through. So the police are a little bit better than what's to come. They then transferred me in a police cruiser, I believe, the next evening to the Rotorua hub. Rotorua hub. They have this interesting thing going on in their cells, which is the reasoning is so they can constantly see what you're doing in there. But there's this blue light that's just shining 24/7, so it's quite difficult to sleep unless you cover your head with a blanket. You figure out pretty quickly how to overcome the things that are quite taxing on your psychology and your spirit, your waiwa and all that sort of stuff. But there I was also deprived of water and electrolytes for maybe just under or over 24 hours. I figured out pretty quickly it was dependent on who the sergeant was that was on. So once the afternoon shift came on in the Rotorua hub, things got a lot better. There was a very good sergeant on who finally got me a visit with my family, got me some water and electrolytes.
From your family?
Yep, from my family. And then the next day, it was quite interesting. I won't go into the details about it, but they got a blanket out. The acting sergeant who engaged in this was, I actually thought he was quite a good dude. He got a blanket out. They rolled me onto the blanket. They dragged me down to the bus for Spring Hill Prison. They sort of failed a few times. There was a lot of sweat, a lot of cursing, a lot of laughter from me. I thought the whole experience was quite entertaining.
So your thing was just totally passive resistance?
Oh, yeah, because you have a lawful right to passive resistance.
Of course.
You have a lot of people have a lot of rights that they're not actually aware of. For example, I know of this specific one. Everyone has the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, suffering no detention, no arrest, no search or seizure. And, of course, none of those right, that right there wasn't actually honoured. I haven't been proven guilty. Sure, there's a guilty verdict that's been gone out there, but I haven't been proven guilty. And I certainly hadn't been presumed innocent until otherwise. And detention, arrest, search and seizure had all occurred. And so I absolutely had a lawful right to not accept offers from those who were in charge of my detainment. But, you know, doing it in a dignified and honourable way is probably the most important part of that. And a lot of the guys that were in charge of doing things that probably breached their own obligations and procedures, they had some respect for that, but they still had to do their job. And full credit to the acting sergeant down at the Rotorua police station. He did a good job of doing it in a way that didn't inflict harm, injury or loss onto me. So I actually shook his hand afterwards. But that's when the decency started to ratchet down quite a lot. I was transferred to Spring Hill.
To be clear, you haven't had your day in court at this point.
Well, I hadn't attended sentencing, no.
Okay, so you'd been found guilty but didn't attend sentencing.
Well, yes, there was a guilty verdict entered, sure.
Yeah. But you haven't been sentenced, and so up until this point, why are they holding you? They're holding you to appear for sentencing. What's the reason? What's the logic of them holding you first in a police cell and then to Spring Hill?
Well, here's the irony here. The irony was is that they didn't believe I would that I would attend the sentencing that was set for on, I think it was the 7th of August. And what would it, we'll get to this because I'll explain it.
So they're holding you so they can make you go for sentencing. That's the logic at this stage.
That's the logic at this stage, absolutely. That's the claim that was made in the Tauranga Court, that if they allowed me to go on my own free recognizance, that I would not attend sentencing. Of course, there was no proof for that claim. They even asked for it. They said they couldn't provide it. But
presumably you can be sentenced in absentia if you don't turn up and then arrest you then.
Sure. That didn't happen, though.
No. So they ship you through to Spring Hill, and your position is, I'm passively resisting everything because I don't accept...
Hang on. No? My position is that I will accept sustenance that I'm required for my survival from trusted sources.
Yes.
If it doesn't come from trusted sources, then I can't trust it. So it's unreasonable for me to make a contradiction of myself to receive sustenance from trusted sources. So the hunger strike, it's pure... reasoning was I wanted to maintain my lawful standing, and I didn't think that the entity that was offering the sustenance had a lawful standing.
And is there an interesting thing there that you have a right to sustenance, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and if you don't accept their food, you have a right to organise and provide your own food? Is that a contested point, or what's the logic there?
Well, they contested it at the start, but as things went on, it became that the policies and procedures that they were meant to be following were in complete contradiction to what they did.
Okay.
So they even say that you have a right to engage in a hunger strike. They also say in their policies and procedures that you're not allowed to move someone who's engaging in a hunger strike. They did that. They had a policy and procedure and where if a hunger strike where someone hadn't had water for 72 hours, they'd to go immediately to hospital. They didn't follow that. There was no policies and procedures that prevented them from bringing sustenance in sealed bottles or containers into the prison. So they just made it up until it got to a dire circumstance and where someone from the Ministry of Health, whether it be a doctor or a general practitioner there, told them, well, you know, why don't you allow this? And all of a sudden, it's allowed now. So okay. it was an interesting journey and where I was asking all these questions. I was asking for the written proof of the policies and the procedures, never received them. And then all of a sudden it would be as if those things didn't exist when I either almost died or my health got to a critical point and where they were potentially looking at some liability.
You're one tough cookie.
Well, yeah, I like doing things the hard way. You learn the most through that route. And hopefully through doing that, other people will learn too without... I guess having to do it as well. Although, you know, I'm not saying people shouldn't do it as well. I think people should hold firm their lawful boundaries. I mean, one of the t-shirts that I have that was manifested out of what so many amazing people did down in Wellington, held the line all the day. They did that. They created that t-shirt. That t-shirt's theirs, that hold the line t-shirt. That's the deeper meaning behind that phrase is, hold the line for moral objectivism and moral values and lawful behaviour and do whatever it takes to make sure that that stands.
Good for you. They get you on the bus, take you to Spring Hill. Then what?
They make a whole bunch of claims that don't actually... I mean, they try and get me to sign a few stuff. I ask some questions along the lines of, am I required to sign that? They don't know. Hardly any of them know. Least of all management. There were some wonderful PCOs in there that I met that did know what I was doing. And
what's
why
a PCO?
I've actually forgotten the abbreviation. It's one of the officers that are in charge of the unit.
Okay.
But there were some great ones in there. Like I said to Paul Brennan, the guards and many of the PCOs that I met there, 90% of them, 80 to 90% of them, great. I didn't end up having a lot of respect for management. To be honest, with private conversations with guards, a lot of them didn't have any respect for management either. And the consensus reason seemed to be that they don't work from the bottom to the top.
Yeah.
They come from other organizations and they don't actually know the organization that they're hypothetically managing.
Mm. So they're sticking bits of paper in front of you and at Spring Hill and saying, mm-hmm. sign this, and you say no.
They even got a blank piece of paper and said, just sign this with a note saying you want to go to segregation. And I said, well, what's the alternative? And they said, well, we don't have an alternative. And I said, well, would you sign a blank check? He goes, no. I was like, well, why do you want me to sign this then? He goes, well, we just, you know, you want to go to segregation, don't you? And I was like, when did I say I want to go to segregation? What's the alternative? And they said, oh, we could take you to mainstream with the mobsters and the murderers. I was like, is that a veiled threat? And then they just shut the door. So you ask enough questions, they get frustrated, management gets frustrated and shuts the door. Well, the ones that don't have much control over their, I guess, frustration that you're not doing things the way
they do it. Their whole point is to break you, right?
Well, that's what the approach appeared to be aimed at. It wasn't about fulfilling policies and obligations to make sure that prisoners are mentored towards being correct in society. A lot of the management strategy seemed aimed at breaking my hunger strike through coercion, through intimidation. I mean, the first year after out of that office, when they decided that they weren't going to be able to coerce me to sign anything, they sent me to high security and they gave me a blanket with stab holes in it and a blood stain on it, and then wouldn't bring anything else. So I just had like the mattress and a blanket, and I sort of laughed to myself. I was like, oh yeah, is this the start of the intimidation angle that they're working on? So I went to sleep and I woke up in the morning and I was interested in the yard. So I was looking out at the yard and watching guys work out really intensely. Some of them are a whole lot fitter than I've ever seen in rugby teams that I've played in. And I got out for some free time and I started yarning to some of the prisoners in there. And I actually sort of quickly figured out that they were a lot like some of the guys I grew up with in South Auckland. I met one of the guys who it was alleged that they were part of the Waikerea fires that burnt down the prison. He was an interesting bloke. Then the PCO that was in charge of that unit, I actually really liked this guy. He was probably one of the best guys I've ever met. He said, you know, what are you doing here? Come in here. Got me a phone call with my mum. I had a brief chat with him. He did everything properly. I have huge respect for him. And he made sure I was where I was supposed to be according to their policies and procedures, which was the health unit. That was where I needed to be right from the start, because I hadn't had water for what was becoming a longer amount of time, and I hadn't had food since I was detained. So that was the correct move. He was in charge of that, and he made sure that it happened. And so I moved to the health unit. Unfortunately, things started getting worse once I moved to the health unit.
That's ironic.
There were a lot of mentally unwell guys in there that probably would have benefited from, you know, King Seat being upgraded to be better for mental health rather than just shut down. Te Aho Mai maybe given some more resources instead of sending mentally unwell individuals straight to a prison that, in my opinion, is probably under-resourced and not managed with the correct expertise. So there was a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, a lot of banging on the walls, and especially in some of the units, like the isolation unit, some of them are sent down there because they're still high on meth. So this banging, screaming, shouting, barking sometimes could go on for almost 72 hours straight. So it can be maddening for some of the individuals in there that are actually suffering from mental health issues.
I visited Parimarimo's unit for that, and I was there for like 5 minutes and I was terrified.
Yeah,
because you're not used to people just screaming constantly.
Yeah, I wasn't used to it.
And one person was like smearing feces over the walls. And
yep, we had someone like that there too.
And you're amongst that in a cell.
I was next to it, yeah. And because they like to shout underneath the door, it reverberates all through the hallway and you can't hear nothing but that.
That would be torture.
It was a little bit. My response to hide my fear is anger. And so I was quite dishonourable in the way that I responded to that a lot of the time. And then afterwards I would feel really guilty and put my mouth under the door and say, sorry, bro, I shouldn't have responded like that. And because a lot of the time if you did get a chance to speak to these screaming individuals, they would respond to you quite well because you're not wearing a uniform of that indicates detainment. So in the unit I was moved to, there was a prisoner there who wasn't entirely mentally unwell. I actually found out later on he had some tragedies happen in his life, and that's why he's quite an angry individual. But he responded well to me when I communicated with him because I was wearing the same gear as he was. So there's quite a real brotherhood sort of, I guess, concept that sort of forms around people there, and you can get through to people. The entire time I was there, I never actually experienced any malice, any cruelty, any aggression from any of the fellow prisoners. Wow. I only got it from guards or medical staff. And any of the aggression that I experienced was only in response to them wiling out over their addictions or the fact that they're detained, and then me responding in an awful way and they'd shout back, F up, all that sort of stuff. Mm. But that was just me not finding a way to get through to them properly. But other than that, never had any issues with any of the prisoners, even in high security, even in the low security health unit. It was always what the guards were being directed to do by management and the medical team. That was the only adversity I actually encountered.
Okay. So you're in this health unit with quotation marks.
Yeah.
You're refusing water and food.
Well, I'm requiring it from trusted sources.
Yes, sure. Other than from trusted sources, sorry, you're requiring it from trusted sources that you nominate, and it's not coming.
No, and here's the funny thing. They have it. They have it there. They've confiscated it from my property, and my police have transferred my property. There's at least three bottles of 1.5-litre water. There's electrolyte juices there. They're informed of this the entirety of the time. And even at one point, they bring my paperwork out of that property into my cell, or into the cell, and then they leave the water and the juice there. It's there the whole time. It's literally just a van drive away. And I'm asking for this over and over again, and they say, oh, we'll check with management, and nothing ever comes. And while I'm in the health unit, this is carrying on. I'm informing my family of what's going on. I'm getting medical checks, although not all the proper medical checks. Like, they didn't do ketone tests until the ambulance my mother called arrived, and they turned it away. That was probably one of the most important tests. A ketone test measures the amount of proteins that are in your blood. So if you're on a hunger strike and you haven't eaten, especially if you're not taking any electrolytes or sugars and stuff, what happens is your body starts to eat the fats or go into a state of ketosis. And so it floods your blood with proteins. And those ketone levels can get quite high. And what can happen is your blood can get into a state of acidosis and can start melting away the fat from your organs, which, you know, that can be interpreted as a good thing, but it can go too far and start damaging your organs. They all laid out this risk to me. They knew it. And they said, do you comprehend these risks, or do you understand these risks? And I said, well, I'm not a medical professional, but you seem to understand these risks. And I've asked you multiple times to get in touch with management to make sure that I have things that can help me manage this hunger strike in a healthy way, but nothing's happening. And this carried on until I was over 100 days without water. I had to crawl and be helped by one of the guards to the
hospital. Sorry, 100 days without water?
Yeah, it was over 100 days.
Like, no water?
No water.
How do you survive?
Will. Strength of will. One of the hallucinations that I had, I was standing. I basically came out of it, and the last words I'm not going to talk about the details of the hallucination because that's quite private to me. We had a tragedy in our family and an individual that died in relation to that tragedy, in relation to the things that we've all been struggling under and talking about through shows like yours. That happened to us, and that individual was in that hallucination, and the last words in that hallucination was, call an ambulance. And so I tried to press the emergency button to have the ambulance called, and the woman on the other end says, just go back to sleep. And so it wasn't till 10 o'clock the next morning I was able to get to the phone to beg mum to call the ambulance because they're not doing anything. She calls the ambulance turns up, they turn it away, and then they start scrambling to make sure that there's no liability here for them and that they haven't missed any obligations that are on them. And they realize they haven't done a ketone test yet. So they go and do a ketone test and they find that it's five times the normal limit. They freak out, call the ambulance that my mum had called back, and I'm going to hospital to be rehydrated. And then after that's done, I go back.
How sick were you at this? I can't imagine it. I didn't think you could survive.
I had salt cramps. I was woozy. Things were spinning. The dizziness was getting worse. I was losing strength in my muscles. I found it hard to walk without falling. I was worried that if I fell, I would smash my head and then I'd lose all control. So moving was, I was crawling for safety. And the hallucinations were just coming in waves. Like when they came to do the ketone test they hadn't done yet, I thought I was staring at the ceiling. And then next thing, it was like a slide had just come across my face and one of the medical team was there looking at me, and I thought, what's going on? Now we're going to do a test on you. So I was losing consciousness, coming back. And when the ambulance arrived and they gave me some IV fluids and some glucose sachets, it was like, what was it like? It was like I was desperately trying to suck on it and get it in me. Like I wanted it really bad. And finally I was getting it from someone I could trust a source, so to speak. And after all that hospital ordeal, the rules of not allowing water in from trusted sources changed. Mum could bring water in whenever she wanted now.
You would be suffering for weeks on that position that you had and how they were treating you. Mm-hmm. 100 days. You'd be in agony.
100 hours.
100 hours. I heard 100 days. Sorry. I'm talking. Yeah, sorry, 100 hours. Phew. 100 hours. You would be suffering in agony for those 100 hours, hallucinating, and potentially dying.
I felt like that was the case in between the hour window 85 to 90 to 100, 105. Before that, I was doing things like I'd jump in the shower, feel some water on me, close my eyes, imagine that the water falling on me was rehydrating me, and then I would go back and sit down, I would cross my legs, I would think that I had everything that I needed. I would try and know that rather than just believe it. And that would work until, you know, the thoughts that I have conversations with my family, I would hear intense concern. I would hear what their actual policies and procedures were and how they were breaching me. And then my mind would shift to that and things would get even more difficult as more time went by to deal with it. That's why they have those policies and procedures there. They're a large organization and they need to respond in a way that maintains the safety of the ones that they proclaim to be acting in the beneficial interest for. They weren't doing that. And everyone has a right to hunger strike. They agreed to that. If someone else went to do a hunger strike and didn't have the strength of will I had, they may have died earlier. And that's why they have those obligations and they have those policies and those obligations. is to make sure that they actually are acting in a beneficial interest to the individual they're trying to correct. They weren't doing that. They were just trying to break the hunger strike.
Wow. Someone,
it's a form of torture.
Yes, absolutely. Someone's texted in and asked, and you may, if you don't can't tell us or don't want to tell us, that's fine, but what did you end up being charged with and being convicted of?
I can't answer that.
Okay, fair enough.
And not just because not because I know the answer to that. It's because I don't really know the full truth of that yet. Like, that process isn't over yet.
Okay.
We still need to figure out whether there actually is a conviction. We need to still actually go through the process of resolving that, because there's been no remedy. So until that process is resolved, I can't give a full picture on that. I can give a full picture of what I've struggled through this.
Yes.
Because that's finished now. My struggle with that's over.
Okay.
But in terms of legal matters and processes in the future, I can't talk about that until it's resolved.
Got it. So your 110 hours, was that 110 hours?
Yeah, about between 100 and 105, something like that, yeah.
Without water and food?
Without water, yeah. It was days without food. So, and the strategy was to just lock the food in there in an attempt to tempt me to eat it, and that would go on for days.
Wouldn't you be in the shower just wanting to push your tongue out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you wouldn't.
Well, when you think about it, when I would think about it, there was just something stronger that wouldn't let me do that.
Wow.
Couldn't do it. Even like I would go to and I would be like, nah. There was a prisoner when I got moved to another block that said, bro, I can get you some food on the D-Lo and no one has to know. I said to him, I was like, but I will know. And something more eternal than me will know. And this, more importantly, is between me and that eternal essence. I don't really care about what other people think. For the longest time while I was in there, I didn't want my mother and my family going to the media. I wanted this kept private.
Yes.
But the biggest part about this hunger strike was about me and that eternal essence, nothing else. I didn't care what other people thought, still don't care what people think. It was about me instilling the greatest form of privation that I could, so I could come out of this better. That's what it was about at the heart of it. It wasn't about what people thought of it. It wasn't about political protest.
You weren't grandstanding.
No. For the longest time, nobody knew I was even in there. That was because we decided on that as a family. It was only when things got so bad that my mum was like, nah, we need help. Because they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing.
So they, after this 105-hour episode, they get the ambulance back that they turned away that your mother had called, and they took you to hospital. And they pumped you full in the hospital, in the ambulance they were treating you. They took you to the hospital.
Yep.
And rehydrated you.
Mm-hmm.
What did that feel like?
Oh, it was amazing. I was treated by a doctor there who was, to me, the epitome of competence. I thought that individual was just amazing. It was almost as if the environment changed drastically when I got out of that management scenario into this management scenario. And the worst part about that realization is they were under the pump all the time. The health system under the Ministry of Health and the hospitals, they are struggling. They're struggling for numbers. They're struggling for infrastructure. But the people that were left there, all in all, from my perspective, were so much more competent than what I was suffering under at Spring Hill.
Mm.
And it was a massive relief. And even though I was chained to someone for most of the time, 24 hours a day, it was like a nice break. And that was that time in the hospital I got, all I really did was rehydrate, read the Bible, talk to the guards, talk to the nurses, talk to the doctors, and relax. Sometimes get restrictions on my contact with my family, which would really arc me up. But other than that, at least I felt safe.
Which part of the Bible were you reading?
I read all of it in hospital. I actually read it three times because I felt like sometimes when I was reading it, my mind would drift off to other places and I wouldn't read it properly. So I read it three times and I went through it a fourth time to make sure that there were parts that I needed to focus on to comprehend the meaning embedded in a lot of the parables. But my favorite part of the Bible is the book of Matthew.
Mm. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
That must have given you great strength, the temptation, the temptations,
yep.
And Jesus refused them.
Yes, and very good lessons for myself as well. I think one of the parables, it was spoken in the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount in the book of Matthew is the most profound thing I've read, and I've read a lot of things. And the profundity of it was made more apparent to me because of my interest in psychology. And so coming back to that at 37 and reading it again properly really opened up the lessons that are embedded in every single parable that is spoken in that Sermon on the Mount. And one of the parables that I struggle with the most is the judge not that you be not judged. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye but not see the log that is in your own eye? And that's one I've struggled with for a long, long time. I've always had this tendency to see the flaws in other people while being blinded by my own flaws. So that's something I'm going to always have to work on. But the entire Sermon on the Mount is something that people need to really read over and over and over again and really comprehend its full meaning. Because you're left listening to that and thinking, how can someone be that perfect?
Yes.
And then you're humbled by it.
And, of course, you realize he was God.
Yeah.
Tell me, someone's just texted and asked, did you have songs in your head playing that you were listening to?
I would later on when I was shifted to an isolation unit by a very wonderful PCO from the low security area. She'd had enough of what she was observing of my treatment by some of the guard shifts. And she just came in from the unit she was transferred and stopped all of it. She'd had enough. She was amazing. So I was shifted to what's called the isolation unit. No TV. You only have a radio, bed, a desk to write. And that was probably some of the best times for my personal growth. I would do calisthenics. I would write. I would read. And I would write on the blackboard all the unalienable rights, so I would know them off by heart. And I would listen to the radio, and what they'd play most of the time was Life FM. So I hear the songs over and over again, and then that actually filled me with a lot of empowering strength.
Hmm. You're at Spring Hill. You're at the hospital. They get you back on track. Then what happens?
Okay, so I'm back and I'm getting water and I'm repeating to the medical team who are attempting to get my ketones, because my ketones were brought down to 0.2 while I was in hospital. It didn't take them long. And what I deduced from the treatment that it wasn't really the medication, it was mostly to do with the juice. So I started telling the medical team that, you know, you can try and distribute these medications that have been prescribed by the hospital, but they're not going to be the largest part that keeps my blood sugars and ketones stable. You're going to have to allow juice from my family in sealed bottles to come in, because that's the only thing that's actually going to work. And over this time, what made it worse is the medication dispensing was not done in line with the prescription. Some days I'd get some of it. Some days I'd get hardly any of it. Some days I would get too much of the wrong thing.
No.
No, I'm serious. I documented every single day down what they did, how much they gave, and it was just a shambles. And And then my ketones would end up getting up to 7.8 at its worst. And you get, and I, the nurse that took it, let out an audible, oh my God. And oh my God is relevant because it's eight times the normal limit. Like normal limit is between 0.1, 0.6, not higher than one. This was at 7.8. Now they called the ambulance back when it was five times the normal limit, but now they didn't want to send me to hospital and they didn't want to allow sealed bottles of juice to come in. So my condition after coming back from the hospital just went straight back to what it was and then worse. And this would happen right up until the proposed sentencing date. And then right the day before, after me saying, you know, you might as well just send me back. If you're not going to go and get my juice and my water from the RO office or allow sealed bottles of juice to come in from my family, you may as well send me to hospital now so I don't miss sentencing date and turn all of you guys into a bunch of whopping hypocrites. And the doctor kept saying to me, oh, no, I've rung the hospital. The hospital agrees that we can manage you here. Well, they mustn't have been giving them the full story that I detailed down in my journal, because that was certainly wasn't the case. I was worse than what I, in terms of ketones, I was worse than what I was before they took me to the hospital the first time. And then, but right the night before sentencing date, they send me to the hospital. All right, I end up just calling my mother and getting her to call the ambulance, and then the ambulance takes me to hospital. And I wait there for 11 hours, just drinking water, drunk maybe a couple of bottles of water while I was waiting. I took a blood test. Now, the reason they sent me to hospital is because my potassium levels were high and they were concerned I was going to have a heart attack. By the time I'd waited for 11 hours to see a doctor at the hospital, they did a blood test and found that my potassium levels were normal. And then they got me bottles of juice and I drank juice, drunk juice, drunk juice. And then they did a ketone test and my ketone levels had dropped in half. And I said, well, that's what I've been telling Spring Hill the whole time. I really only need juice, not medication. And so she helped, the doctor helped out in that regard in terms of the discharge notice. And I managed to discharge myself out, get back to Spring Hill at 6. The sentencing was supposed to be 11. But Spring Hill had told them the day before that I may not make sentencing because I've been sent to the hospital, and then didn't tell them that I was back in time for sentencing. And so the court was told I wasn't going to make it because I was at hospital and I missed sentencing and it was put off till November. So I was going to have to carry on this hunger strike while trying to get them to maintain their obligations to their policies that actually existed, and fail and get pushed to points where things were really bad before they'd actually adhere to those policies. You know, detaining me so I would make sentencing ended up not being true because they messed it up. All they had to do
was... They went out of their way to mess it up.
Yeah, and then when I got back, I actually finally had a conversation with two individuals that claimed to be from health management who apologized for all of it. And one of them, who was quite lovely, said that if I needed anything, I could contact her. Well, do you think I ever was able to get in contact with her at all after that? No. But I did start getting sealed bottles of juice from family. My ketones dropped over the course of 1 to 2 days to back into the point values once that started. And I was able to exercise again.
It seems that you were determined on your course of action.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to give an inch, management, I mean, and their intention was simply to break you.
That's what it appeared to be.
Because there'd be no harm in letting your family deliver bottles of juice.
Well, we actually proved that it was the opposite. It actually, everything that I said that it would do, it did. And it showed in their own data. They tried for days to get the ketone levels and the blood sugars back to normal zones with improper application of the prescription from the Waikato Hospital. In less than 2 days, we did it with water and juice brought in from my family, and it showed in their own data. That's the insanity in all of this. I told them beforehand. They disagreed. They brought it to crisis point by continuing to not listen to me and my mother and their own policies and procedures. They then reneged on their position, and then through their own data, they were proven wrong.
The entire purpose of keeping you and locked up was so you could make sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went out of their way to make sure you missed it and stayed locked up.
Yeah, I mean, they could have just sent me to the hospital days ago when the ketone levels were at 7.8, got some juice, and then I would have made the 7th of August, and who knows what would have happened then. But what would end up happening, we all know, is that I would end up staying there for another close to 2 months, and the hunger strike would go on for 73 days, and I would be released on the 77th day.
And that's what happened.
That's what happened. There was a whole lot worse that happened after that, but it's another 150 pages of journal, because the coercion and the work, the teamwork in that coercion would only ramp up.
What was the worst?
About 50 days into the hunger strike, things were going pretty well. So I'll start with the one that's less worse than that. They went to move me out of the health unit because someone made a claim that I was eating. When I asked the PCO of that unit whether I was eating, he said, well, you're drinking juice and water. I said, is that an example of eating? And he said, no. Oh, so you agree with me that I'm not eating? And he goes, oh, look, mate, this is not my decision. And I said, well, cool. Can I have the proof that the manager who I talked to when I got back from the hospital has signed off on me being moved to another unit that's not a health unit while still being under a hunger strike that you've agreed that I'm still on? And he goes, yeah, sure, we'll go and get that. And they never did. They just kept coming back asking me if I would move. And I said, gladly, so long as you provide the proof that health management has signed off on this. Well, they determined that I was refusing to move to this other unit. I didn't actually. It sounded like a great idea. I would actually get more yard time and more interaction with prisoners. Sounded great to me. But I just wanted proof that they were doing things properly. And because they determined that I refused, they got a large amount of guards dressed up in armored gear. They barged into the cell. One of them slammed their shield into my head, and then they dragged me out and all my gear and force-moved me over to the next unit. And so that was one of the things that was pretty unnerving. The next thing that they did is one guard shift that was particularly awful at this new unit decided they were going to pretend that I didn't give my empty water bottle. So I went to exchange an empty bottle and then put my hands for a pat down on the wall because they directed me to do that first. So I put the bottle down on the ground. I've done this many times and they've still exchanged the empty bottle out for a full bottle of water. On this occasion, they decided to pretend like I never gave them the empty water bottle, so therefore we're not getting you a full water bottle. I engaged in a series of actions that would end up proving that they actually did refuse to start giving me the water that my mother was bringing in. And this put me in a position where they were refusing me water for 48 hours. Now, during this period, I was struggling with thrush. Medical team knew about the thrush. They didn't want to bring in coconut oil to treat it. The thrush was getting worse. It turned into esophageal thrush, and then it went down into my stomach. After the 48 hours of no water, that thrush got worse, and I started vomiting uncontrollably for days afterwards, to the point where they sent me back to the hospital, and that's when you guys actually learned that there was something really wrong going on in there. And the vomiting just wouldn't stop. It got to a point where I was vomiting up bile. I realized later that it could have been possibly because my body was trying to get all the thrush out of me because it was getting worse and the juice was making it worse. And because I couldn't get coconut oil, I couldn't control it either. And so it was getting to a point where my health was being compromised to a point where even drinking juice to keep my ketone levels would aggravate the thrush. And then my body would want to get rid of the thrush, so I would vomit, which would then make me dehydrated, and I was just spiraling out of control. And that was the point where the wonderful guard that used to be in charge of that unit came over, sent me to isolation, made sure that something was being done to get me on a refeeding program, of which I'd been asking for weeks. And by day 60-something, that was finally all sorted out. I'd been asking for a refeeding program since day 40. And I think that was probably the worst thing that happened. Like, they purposefully pretended as if I'd never given them an empty bottle for water and then refused to give me water for that. And then the thrush got worse and it just spiraled out of control.
It's like something out of a Japanese POW camp where they're just playing with your mind.
It was certainly psychological warfare, but I wouldn't lay claim to it being as bad as...
No, of course.
Like, you know.
But you know what I mean. It's that. It's not what you expect in a New Zealand prison.
No, definitely not. Like, it's not something that we should ever lay claim to having here in a rights-based country. Like, we're the West. We're meant to acknowledge the rights of individuals. We're meant to be helping individuals who are engaging in unlawful behavior and help them correct themselves. That's why they called themselves corrections. They claim to be the embodiment of that. Now, the problem I have with this organization is that many individuals are working in there and engaging in behavior that literally contradicts that. Right, you might as well call yourself a gulag or start being open and honest to people in terms of the direction that many of these individuals are trying to take it in. And most alarming of all is it seems to be management that are wanting to take it in that direction. Right? If we're going to sit here as the West and criticize what the East does and the way that they manage and take care of their people, we should stop right now. If that's what we're going to do in our facilities that we call corrections, because that's not correcting people. The most profound prisoners I met in there were the ones that had engaged in a conscious effort to correct themselves. Now, I would like to see corrections to push itself to the point of assisting in that, right? I was certainly prepared to engage in a campaign to correct myself, even if I was of the firm position that I was innocent of the charges. But I wasn't assisted in that by management. I was certainly supported in that by many of the mentor-minded guards, and I acknowledge that. But I would like that attitude in management, because we wouldn't be having this conversation today if it was.
Did the other prisoners know of your circumstance?
Yeah. They were great about it too.
They respect you for it?
Some of them would actually end their phone call early and allow me to jump on the phone so I could get some chat with my family time. Some of them just couldn't believe that I'd gone that long without food. They certainly believed it when they started seeing how much weight I'd lost. Like, some of them were going, nah, he must have food in the cell. But after being around them in the unit that I was transferred to after the health unit for days and days and days, and they started seeing the rapid weight loss.
They knew.
Yeah, and they had a huge amount of respect for it. But I had a huge amount of respect for a lot of them too. They put themselves in routines. One of them said, when I asked if you could be released tomorrow and say someone could organize that for you, would you take it? Because I'd been listening to him. He'd been giving me some of his books because I couldn't get books out without signing things. And the books he was giving me were unbelievably profound. And I found him to be an amazing dude. And he replied to me with reference to that question, nah, I probably got a lot more good that I could get out of this experience. I could lose a bit more weight. I could read a bit more books. You know, I could tone my aggression down a little bit. And I thought that was incredible. I actually thought that he was ready to leave. I think that prison, when you're still anxious about trying to get out of prison, you probably still need to be there. When you stop being anxious for tomorrow and be comfortable for today's struggles, or comfortable with today's struggles, you're good, or you're on the path to being good. And in fact, that's a parable in the Sermon on the Mount. Do not worry for tomorrow. Sufficient of the day are its own troubles. And I realized that I was on my way out of there when I stopped being anxious for tomorrow, and I just sat in the moment and trying to improve myself wherever that needed to be improved.
My goodness me. How was it that you ended up getting out?
There were some warrior wahines on the outside that did some pretty good paperwork. Sentencing was rather closed up. The presumption was time served. And like that, I was free, and I was going to the RO office, and the irony was I got my property, and there's all the bottles of water, and there's all the electrolyte juices all there. And I was like, oh, now I can have these when it's all over. And then when they went to get me out, I asked, can I go back to this unit to give my thanks to this PCO who kind of saved my life and got me to the hospital for the refeeding program, or gave her assistance towards that endeavor? And they're like, no, you have to go now. I was like, okay. Well, right now? And they're like, yes, you have to leave now. I was like, well, they couldn't have got me out faster.
So their position was, if I'm inferring correctly what you're saying, that you've done your time, you're a free man, and whatever crime they've convicted you of, it's now all square.
I would presume that's their position, but we'll have to see. The journey continues.
It's clearly not over for you.
Oh, no, the journey's never over. And if there's some harm, injury or loss that doesn't have any lawful backing to it, there must be a remedy. There has to be, right? I don't care for penance. Penance is something that you got to do within yourself. If you have to do some sort of punishment to figure out what that penance is, then so be it. I did mine. It may not have been for it. I may have been innocent of the charges that were levied at me, but I certainly gained my penance in my own way to help me be a better man for my family and my community and all those who support me out there. And so I've done that. Right? I don't require any punishment to do that. I've always attempted to do that. But there's still no remedy for the harm that was generated for no reason, no reasonable reason whatsoever. And so this journey will continue until that remedy is provided to everybody who got involved and tried to exert some form of loss on those I care about, whether that be my family or my community. You will provide the remedy for that situation, or I will go out and make sure that it's done. And I think that everybody should do the same. If there is no remedy, there is no way to move forward.
Well said. What's your health like now?
It's good. I've got some niggling injuries that are sort of coming up as I'm trying to start exercising again. I really need to concentrate on making sure I don't include things that were prevalent in my diet that's not good for me. I want to make sure that all the good things that I've gained from this experience in privation stay, and I don't go back into old habits. But mentally, I'm stronger than ever. So the body will follow.
And your friends and family, you must be tighter than ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have our moments, but...
Well, all families do. It's part of getting tight, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I think that we can... I think we have the potential to take on tougher challenges and conquer them. Yeah, that's part of... Like, a lot of people have sent me messages, you know, what's happened to you is really horrible. I feel for you. And I can't help but sense a sense of despair in that. And that's not what I want from people. I understand there's going to be a bit of concern in that, and that's cool. I thank you for all of that and love you for all of that. But for me, the biggest sense that I, the biggest emotional sense I take out of this is I took on an organization. I held my line on that. I held to my principles and I won.
Yes.
Yes, there were some hard, dark days throughout that, but the biggest lesson everyone needs to learn is don't avoid the difficult things. Go through, conquer them, walk together to make it just a little bit easier to do, but do them nonetheless. Do the hard things. I had a mate who I stepped out of the way of at my previous job so he could take the team leader role. And he was really unsure of himself. But when I was having hard days as a team leader, he would say to me, Brad, you can do hard things. And I would think about that in my head and I'd get into a little bit of arrogance and resentment over how hard the day was. And I'd just repeat this, his kind, calm face saying to me, Brad, you can do hard things. And I'd walk up to him and I'd give him a hug and say, you know what, bro, you're right, I can. I say to everybody out there that's struggling under the privation of these tippy toes to tyranny, you can do hard things. I know you can, because I did, and I'm better for it.
Very impressive, Brad. It's just a great lesson. It's a great lesson in how you, right amongst us, right here with us on RCR, that you stick to your principles and you can't be broken. And all the while, you had this faith.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like there was an angel with you?
Always. Now more so than ever. Doubt and weight and the wavering of the struggles of the body sometimes gets in the way. But when you're about to give up and there's that firm no that comes in, yeah, you know, you know something stronger is there with you in those moments, for sure. You know it. Because all of a sudden you're just filled with this, nah, it's not over. And you're good.
Well, Brad, on behalf of everyone, thank you.
Thank you, Rodney.
You've inspired me. And you've inspired me that I can do a lot more than I ever imagined I can do in this fight against tyranny.
You inspired me when you were an MP, mate.
Oh, well, that's very kind. That was pretty modest.
It loops around, doesn't it? It comes back.
Well, that's kind of you to say.
But what you do here and now echoes into eternity and especially into others, whether you know it or not.
Mm. Well, you're looking good. You're looking very, very healthy. And you have a depth to you. I can see your face and your eyes. And you have a depth to you of someone who has known extreme privation. I don't know how to say the word.
You had it right the second time.
And have tested yourself beyond what anyone would think is humanly possible and possibly is humanly impossible, but you had your spirit with you.
Mm.
And you came through. and you have that look about you, I wouldn't want to mess with you if I was an authority at the moment, Greg.
I think a lot of those who presume to be an authority have decided it's easy just to wave the white flag. And when an organization starts doing that, then you can know, then you know that some things that you thought were impossible were never impossible at all.
Here's a quick text, Brad. Hi, Rodney. Blessings to Brad and his family. I'm very proud of their courage against the system and Brad's internal courage. Thank you, and thank you, the team RCR, from Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
Brad, truly, thank you for this morning. If you ever want to talk to us about something, just let us know. You are a very, very special person to us. I thought we were helping you and your mum, and it turns out you were helping your mum and you were helping us.
Goes both ways.
Does, doesn't it?
Yep.
Thank you so much. That was Brad Flutie. Oh, my goodness, what a story. I'm quite moved. I'm going to have to go to a song, Dave, and recover myself. We've got a song, Shine, by Shannon Noel.
The RCR phone lines are now open.
Hey, Brad.
Call 0800 2057 57.
The trouble with that is I'm going to struggle to carry on. Man, oh, man, that was so amazing.
Thanks, mate.
You're so good. I can see it. I would not want to mess with you. They've picked the wrong guy.
Yep.
Keep
well, the right one.
Yeah.
Oh,
the right one. Please stay in touch and give our greatest love to your mum.
I will.
Take care, brother.
Thank you, mate.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.